Hello, and welcome to Foothold America's U.S. Expansion Mini-Pod, Three Questions, One Voice. I'm your host, Joanne Farquharson, President and CEO of Foothold America. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Arvinder Yubi, a partner with Ellis Porter UK, a leading immigration law firm in the U.S. and U.K. Arvinder leads Ellis Porter's U.S. Expansion Service for foreign corporations and individuals. When it comes to immigration, you need both knowledge and experience. Arvinder has both, as he was born in the UK, studied law in the US, worked as an immigration attorney in Canada, and is now back in London. He knows what it's like to go through the process. Arvinder is a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and has helped dozens of Foothold America clients successfully obtain their visas to reside in the US. Alrighty, let's get started with our three questions, hearing one voice, Mr. Arvinder Yubi.
So let's get started with our first question. This one could be a sticky one because we just had the U.S. election, It's on people's minds. But how do you expect the new U.S. administration to affect immigration rules and timelines for business owners seeking U.S. residency?
Sure. So this has been something that probably for the past 2-3 months, if not a little bit longer, has been front and center of most of our clients' attention, and certainly over the past couple of weeks, we've had a lot of calls with clients. But the reality is there are going to be changes, and there would have been changes regardless of who had won. With a new administration, there's always going to be some changes, good and bad. So the short answer is we don't know. We don't know what's going to change and how much is going to change if there are any changes. So we've been telling all of our clients just to not panic. Don't make huge changes to your organization, programmatic changes that impact, you know, all foreign nationals or the ability to bring people to the US. Really, a lot of our approach is be pragmatic about it. Let's look at what's happened historically and see if there are things that you can do within your organization that can help smooth over any potential changes, but not necessarily shake up the entire organization as a whole. But in terms of if we do look at historically what's happened, you know, last time, 2016 to 2020, we saw a lot more scrutiny in almost all visa classifications. We saw increased scrutiny at the Department of State level, and that's working with the U.S. Embassy. So once you have your petition approved by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, normally it's quite a formulaic process and you get your visa. During that last administration, the last Trump administration, we saw sometimes there were challenges at the U.S. Embassy. So we had to over-prepare our clients for those things. We saw the Buy American, Hire American program come out where that really did have challenges in the ability to obtain certain types of visas. There was a lot more scrutiny on the H-1B visas, for example. And some officers take that upon themselves to maybe increase scrutiny even further on certain applications. So I would definitely see a lot more scrutiny on almost all visa classifications, probably at the U.S. Embassy as well. I'm telling our clients to just plan a little bit for the unexpected. Things have been pretty smooth over the past couple of years in practicing immigration law. And so we've had, you know, some standardized processes where we can say, you know, with reasonable certainty, we're very comfortable that these cases will be approved without issue. That may not be the case. Extensions, again, they may become a little bit more challenging. And so plan ahead, plan early, talk with your immigration lawyers early and often.
Right. So when you say increased scrutiny, do you mean, you need to prepare more, as you said? Is it going to manifest itself more in the length of time it takes? Or when you went through, when we were 2016 to 2020, or really any change of administration, do you see a dramatic change in the percentages of different visas that are declined? And then if you've got, you know, you see a client and they're H-1B-1 generally, but then you see, hey, this is, we're having a big change in approvals, so we should pivot and try this other one. Do you see it that dramatically, or is it more just about maybe the period of time it takes?
No, in 2016 to 2020, it was definitely pretty that dramatic in that we're really looking at, when we're presenting cases, going over and above what we ordinarily would have to do and what the regulations require as well. So really, particularly for in the H1B context, explaining who is a specialty occupation. So that's a job that requires a bachelor's degree to perform the job duties. They were being challenged on the initial reviews and in requests for evidence. So working with our clients to really make really strong and robust job descriptions that we're putting forward in part of the application, explaining what responsibilities they have. So if we're working with clients now, we may say to them, look, you predominantly require a lot of software engineers, for example, in your H1B. Maybe let's use the time now to really drill down and understand exactly what they do on a day-to-day basis. Are there tools and softwares that they use that we can specifically go into and drill down now, so that when we do start to file those applications next year, if we see a return back to the 2016 to 2020 period of time, we're more prepared. We've got more robust material to present to the US Embassy or the USCIS and explain how one might qualify for that requirement. It is also looking more at programmatic level. So if you are a company that has a large foreign national population in the US, or is reliant upon having some key individuals in the US, whether it's starting a new entity or you've got existing operations, what does that mean for them? How long do they have in the US? Do they need to strategically shift over to an alternative visa classification that gives them a longer period of time in the US without having to apply for a green card? So it really is at that level. What can you do to put your foreign national employees into the best position possible and give them the most flexibility? We can't wait until the last second to start a green card anymore, because the processing time may increase and probably will increase. Maybe there's going to be an increase in the wage levels, and so it may just become almost too costly to go through that process for a lot of individuals. So part of it is definitely being flexible and being able to pivot to alternative visa classifications if there's one available. And the other part is being prepared and really understanding what does your foreign national population look like over the next 2, 3, 4 years, and how can you try and strategize for that now?
So that is definitely good food for thought when it comes to how things might change. And I just sort of as a follow-up to that, do you find that people will come and talk to you, and then after getting a look at, say, the timing and the cost, they kind of go, oh, okay, I'm going to reevaluate whether I, as the founder, am going to the U.S. or whether I'm actually going to send some of my key employees? Do you find that they just kind of go, no, I'm not going to?
I think it really, yes. In short, we do. We see some companies pull back. The reality is, even during COVID, we had companies that really fell into a couple of different categories. Some were, we know it's going to take longer. We know it's probably going to cost more because of COVID. We still need to be in the US. Our products or services are still so valuable. The market is still so big that we just know we're going to absolutely smash it as soon as we can have boots on the ground there. And no matter what, they're still going to go there. We then had a group of individuals who said, we're just going to take a wait and see approach. We're not 100% sure. We're doing okay. Maybe we'll test the water. Maybe we'll run our, sell us goods or services from abroad for a period of time, and we'll see what happens in the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. And then we had some who were just petrified about the entire process. And that may happen again. And they may say, we're so off put by what potentially may happen, or we're not sure of what's going to happen. And so that's enough uncertainty to pull us out. I would say that was a smaller group of individuals. And most of our clients during 2016 to 2020 and COVID, and we had two huge impacts on the immigration system. They really were, we're still going to go ahead because we know this is the right thing to do for the business. We just understand it may take longer, may cost more. And then the others taking a wait and see approach. But the reality is, your business is going to tell you. Demand for your goods and services is really going to drive whether or not you go to the US and how quickly you do that.
Right. Okay. So it probably doesn't have a dramatic shift in the overall strategies for businesses, but they may either change their timeline or, you know, just push forward anyway. What is something business owners should keep in mind when it comes to managing their businesses during unexpected visa delays? Because like with at Foothold, we've had clients, I mean, we're talking, our offices are talking all the time because so-and-so's got their interview and now they're ready to go. And then we're doing the hiring portion and making sure they have health insurance. So how do you help them kind of maintain the momentum of their business as it's related to visas when it comes to some delays?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of it is really just understanding what's allowable and what visa type. So for a lot of our UK and European founders or individuals traveling to the US, they can leverage the ESTA, which allows them to go into the US for up to 90 days, as long as they are not engaging in work or go to conferences, trade shows, doing business development there. That's all absolutely fine. And individuals on B1 visas can do the same thing as well. So I always like to make sure our clients understand the short, medium, and long-term strategies when it comes to immigration. ESTAs and B1s fall into that short-term strategy. So as long as they understand, well, I can still go to the US even if my L1 is received an RFE and it's taking a little bit longer than we'd initially anticipated, I can get to the US on an ESTA. I can still go and meet clients. I can still attend this conference. I can go and market our services in the US. I just understand that I can't do any of the productive work in the US. If you want to go and hire somebody that's going to be your head of US sales, you can go there and hire that person and manage them remotely from UK or from whichever country they're operating out of. So I think that's important to understand the parameters of your ESTA or B1 and how that can be utilized during that time. You may also want to understand exactly what does that mean if you are traveling into the US with a lot of frequency or you want to spend a lot of time there. How can you mitigate some of the concerns officers may have when you enter the US and you say, I want to come back again. I've been here for 2 weeks. I was here, 2 weeks ago. I'm coming back for another 2 week period. I know I'm going to come back in a couple of weeks time again. What do you need to carry with you when you're doing that? And then having key employees in place to be able to handle some of that US work. So some of our clients may have US hires come to the UK or their foreign office for a period of time and train up to really learn the culture and the ethos of the headquarters and understand a little bit more about the company and then have them go back to the US and start running the operations in the US. And that could be a process that, again, we see come back a little bit more.
When your clients say, or they've got a residential visa like an E2, and it's been approved, but for whatever reason, they're not 100% ready to go yet, do they have some flexibility on when they actually enter the US and officially start using their visa?
They do. So especially on the employment-based side, once you have your visa, you don't have to necessarily use it within 30 days or 60 days. You can travel into the US really at any point in time during its validity. Where that becomes a little bit more critical is new office L1s. With a new office L1, you only have a 1 year period of stay in the US before you have to file an extension. And that 1 year doesn't start when you enter the US. It starts when the petition itself is approved by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. So for those new office L1s, we work with our clients very closely to say, realistically, when do you want to be in the US? Because when we file the application, we can put a start date up to 6 months in the future. So if we work with someone now and they say, I want to be in the US or I want the case to be approved on, let's say, January 1st, but they're not planning to travel to the US until March the 1st, they're going to lose that 2 month period of time in the US. And you can't get that back on the first extension. So with those clients, we will say, if you realistically are not going to be in the US until March 1st, let's put a start date of late February to give you a little bit of room, but to make sure you can maximize your full year in the US. On the E2, less of a concern. You get 5 years if you're a UK national. And so if you burn 6 months of that, really not too much of a big issue. But you do have flexibility there. The one area I would say is with the L1s, be mindful of that, particularly for new office L1s.
Right. Okay. So is at the risk of flooding you with more folks that you can help, is it useful for folks who are concerned about delays or changes that might come with the new U.S. administration, which will begin in January 2025, is it worthwhile to come and say, hey, let me just get this going now for some visas where you go, we've got our approval now, but even if you are thinking about mid-2025 for your move, except for the example you just gave with the new office L1, do you feel a sense of urgency, or would you convey that to your clients? Like, let's get this done before January 2025?
Not necessarily. Okay. So there are some benefits to certain applications, but not, I wouldn't say overall everyone should be stopping what they're doing and rushing to file potential visas that they may need in the future. Immigration is complex. The applications are long. They require a lot of documentation. Rushing an application to try and get something in before the new administration starts at the end of January next year, it may result in an attorney doing bad work, submitting a case that really isn't ready to be submitted from a business perspective, and jeopardizing future applications. So trying to rush to be an unknown change in administration doesn't necessarily make sense to me. And I wouldn't be advocating that for any of our clients right now. We also, as a law firm, we will only file cases where the client's case is strong. Even during 2016 to 2020, we did see challenges. We still got a lot of cases approved because we work in a manner where our cases are robust. We've worked with our clients. We know what their business is. We've made sure we've really put together a robust application that's going to face a lot of scrutiny, and we'll be prepared to answer a request for evidence should we get one. Now, we still got some ridiculous decisions that really shouldn't have been refused, but that happened because that was the administration at that point in time. That's what we were dealing with. But I wouldn't say flood the market and just put together an application to try and get it approved now and see what happens. If you get, I think this is really important. A lot of people don't appreciate this. If you get a case approved by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, and then you go to the U.S. Embassy in any country, if your visa is refused, you automatically lose your ESTA. So for an application that, particularly for E2 applications or E1 applications, where the whole thing is put forward to the U.S. Embassy, and the first time you find out whether the case is approved or refused is when you're in front of the officer. If you've rushed to put an application in and the business really isn't ready to support that, or maybe you've pulled together some investments and they're not really solid investments, you haven't documented them well enough, you thought you were going to be able to pay for these higher dollar value investments for the interview, but you just didn't get to them, that can jeopardize the whole case. And you could put yourself or an employee into a position where the case gets refused, they lose their ESTA, so they can't go to Disneyland with their family, or they can't go for business meetings or those conferences, and because they have to apply for a B1 visa, which now takes several months to get. And you spend a lot of money doing that. And when you put your second E2 application in, when you really are ready, officers may look at that and say, look, we saw this case come through 4 months ago. Yeah. What's really changed? We agree with our previous colleague. So I wouldn't rush.
That's great. That's great advice, because for sure, I'm sure you've seen it as well. There's a bit of panic, or I think it's not so much panic, just that sort of uncertainty that bubbles up and makes you ask these kinds of questions. So you had mentioned that you put forward strong proposals and you obviously want them to be well thought out. Don't panic and do something more quickly than you should. But do you find there are times when you're having meetings with clients and you go, we just don't see this as something that's going to be successful obtaining this visa or other visas? We don't see alternatives, and you have to turn clients away. Does that happen?
It does. It does happen from time to time. I think that's part of our job, is to do right by our clients, and doing right sometimes is giving information or guidance or answers that they don't want to hear. But we wouldn't be doing our job if we just said yes to everyone and they got refused. A lot of that goes down to when we file cases, particularly at the US Embassy, whether it's London, Frankfurt, Paris, or anywhere else in the world, our name is going along with that. And a name carries a lot of weight with it, as does other attorney law firms. So you don't want to be that law firm that has a reputation worldwide of just throwing anything at the wall and seeing what sticks. But more so for our clients' perspective, we want to do right by them. We don't want to sell them a visa that they're just not going to meet the requirements for, or their case is going to get refused, because that impacts a whole organization. That organization may have employees that are reliant on them. What we do is, let's look at this from a solution-based approach. You don't meet the requirements for these visa types. Why don't you meet them? How can you fix that? And what period of time is it going to take to really create a strong application? Sometimes our conversations with clients are, as an organization, you may not be ready for an L1 or an E2 visa yet, but your founder is a great candidate for an O1 extraordinary ability visa. Why don't we focus on getting your founder an O1 to be able to start the operations in the US? And maybe in 6, 8, 12 months' time, now let's revisit the E2 when you've got some sales in the US and you've built a small team in the US, and now you really are a strong candidate for an E2 visa. So a lot of the work we do is, let's speak, let's learn about what your business is, what your needs are, what's the most appropriate visa type for not only the individual applicant, but also the business as well. And that's what we think our job is really to be trusted advisors throughout and partners throughout the entire journey to the US.
So let's see, I know you have an important job to help build this case for submission for a particular visa, and that relies in large part on information the client provides you. So what would you say are the common missteps that your founders or business clients make when it comes to applying for a visa and actually putting forth a wonderful application for their visa?
So I think a lot of it is not planning enough for the immigration side of things. So a lot of focus for companies and individuals expanding into the US market is really the tax, the compliance side of it. And I think particularly if individuals are not used to operating the US market, they're used to the European market where prior to some changes, you had the ability to just go and have people move relatively quickly and easily anywhere in Europe. The US immigration system is clunky. It's antiquated. It's very slow moving. So when we talk to clients and we say, this is going to take, this could take 2 months, could take 4 months to get through this process. Like, well, we've committed to our clients and investors that we're going to be there in, 2 weeks time. So it's that, we always say to our clients, talk to us early and often. We may be part 4 or 5 of your journey to the US, but we can tell you we're probably going to be one of the longer parts of the process, because there's parts of the process we can't control. We're not able to expedite cases. We can't go to the US Embassy and say, hey, can we get an appointment tomorrow? We'll pay you a premium processing fee. That's not an ability. We can make discretionary expedite requests and we can speed up the time it takes for us to prepare an application, but we can't control how long the US Embassy takes to review an E2 application. We can't necessarily control how quickly the USCIS approves case other than premium process, but we can't bring that down to 1 day turnaround. It's 15 calendar days in most types. So I'd say the timelines and not planning sufficiently for the timelines takes the longest. The other can be, depending on the visa type, is really looking strategically at who you're sending to the US.
Okay.
So, for the most part, individuals who are managers or executives for the foreign entities who have direct people manager responsibilities or truly in that executive level where they're introducing policies or processes for the organization, they're normally pretty routine cases.
Okay.
When we look at individuals who are not managerial but essential to the business, those specialized knowledge workers, maybe technical individuals, they could be phenomenal at their job. They can be excellent at selling. Those don't necessarily make strong cases in the US, and they fall into cracks in what's considered to be a specialized knowledge role or an essential employee in the E2 role. So again, speaking early and often and really understanding who do we have the best chance of sending out to the US, because sometimes we'll speak with our clients and they say, we've been working on this for 12 months. We want these three people to go out. One's an executive, one's a manager, one's a best salesperson in the UK market. That salesperson may not meet a specialized knowledge requirement under an L1.
Very interesting.
And so sometimes you say, well, we could have used that year maybe to build up their profile a little bit. Maybe we could have had them do some more internal presentations. Maybe you wanted to have them get promoted into a managerial position.
I was just going to ask that. That happens a lot where it's people who are bringing in the sales, and that's what the first step is for US expansion, is to increase those sales. That's really good information. So if they take on a managerial role or have some managerial activities, do some more presenting. Do you mean sort of just out public speaking, or what? How would the presentation piece of it help that if the company does want to send that excellent salesperson? How does that help you improve?
I'm sure. So for the specialized knowledge argument under the L1 visa category, you have to show that somebody has special advanced knowledge about a product or a process that the company has.
Okay.
For some individuals who have designed or developed a product or a process, that's very straightforward. They may even have a patent that has their name attached to it. That's a really straightforward case. Right. For other individuals, especially in the sales world, it's really difficult. They may not have obtained certifications or training that specifically relates to their particular job role. And so going to the US CIS and saying, this person is just a specialized knowledge worker because they're excellent at their job. They're a great people's person. We know they can put them on phone calls and they can sell the client. That's not good enough. That's not specialized knowledge. So how do you demonstrate to the USCIS that somebody has this special or advanced knowledge? Well, that's making them the go-to person within the organization, maybe even within the industry itself. So if they're considered to be a leader in their field, and internally, a company has multiple projects that they're working on, they always bring this one salesperson in for this particular aspect of the job. Maybe they're doing internal trainings to the entire organization, saying, this is, you know, this part of the product, this is how we use it, this is how we sell it in an international market. That can really kind of highlight how critical they are to the organization as a whole. And less so just saying, well, that they're brilliant at their job, but we have no evidence that we can send to you to really demonstrate that. Now, if at least you can present those internal documents to show that they are a leader, that they're somebody, that go-to person for this particular product or service, that can sometimes help in those L1 applications.
Right. I have also noticed that there are times that the founders, say, maybe more on a bootstrapped company where they've been very successful in the UK, and the next generation, their adult child, is going they want to send them to kind of grow the States. Does the same thing fall into place? Like, okay, they may be your child, but that's not going to be good enough to get their visa approved. Would that be the same thing?
Potentially, we would look at how are they qualified to do that. Have they been working at a senior managerial level within the organization abroad for a period of time? Do they really have that skill set to do it? And are they going into the US now at a more elevated role? Maybe they're going into an executive position. They were previously a senior manager position, but do they have the skill sets? It all comes down to, do you qualify? If it was an individual who had not been involved in the organization at all, and they were really just being kind of positioned there because they wanted to keep them busy,
right?
Keeping them out of trouble.
I want to move to Miami.
Exactly. then I would have that conversation with a client and say, if you get to the US embassy stage and an officer asks how your child is qualified to lead this organization, how would they respond? Have they been responsible for managing or reviewing balance sheets, profit losses? Have they ever been involved in any board meetings? Have they hired any senior individuals? Have they been involved in some of your bigger pitches to potential clients? Right. If you can't answer that, the officers will very quickly see through your application.
Great. Okay, good. This is great information because I think sometimes people just, they're more aspirational about the idea, but don't necessarily have the plan in place. We have one bonus question for season one, and this isn't so much about your expertise, Arvinder, but more about your organization as having offices in the UK and the US, and how you as a manager, you're heading up the UK office, how you work with your remote and office employees where they make come from the U.S., they may have, you know, different cultures, and how do you meld those different cultural expectations of your of the Ellis Porter team?
That's a really great question, and the reality is culture really is a huge part of Ellis Porter, and it's not just a tagline that we say. We really believe it, and it comes from the top down. So the two founding partners, Mark and Charju, really truly believe in having a great culture and work environment, and that stemmed from when I first joined Ellis Porter. We were 8 people. We're now, you know, approaching 250 employees. That culture has remained exactly the same as we've gone through that huge growth stage, and it's been paramount to all of our expansion steps. How do we maintain that? What do we need to do? A lot of it is talking with our teams, having open lines of communication. We are heavily involved in having employees suggest or even just start groups that they we do, you know, various different nights, whether it's trivia night, Dungeons and Dragon night. We've got areas that people can collaborate on similar likes. We have a bird group, a Pets of Ellis Porter group. All of it comes down to really being engaged, listening to your teams. We have touch points with our entire remote working population a couple of times a year where we have an open forum and say, let's talk about what challenges are you facing? How can we make you feel more included into Ellis Porter and part of the community so you're not feeling like you're just stuck in your apartment working on these immigration applications? But what's important to you? From a big scale, you know, at the end of the year, we have all of the Ellis Porter remote employees come into Detroit. We fly them out and their partners out to Detroit and have a couple of days of great fun with everyone, get to meet everyone in person, share some great food and drinks with everyone. Throughout the year, we have smaller in-person events that we'll have, you know, we've got a large number of employees now in Chicago and North Carolina and Pittsburgh. So from time to time, we'll have groups of employees fly out to those places and we'll organize a great dinner or an activity, go to a baseball game or go to an event there and have everyone come together. And then if you take a level down from that through, you know, social media and other platforms that we have, we're able to connect on a daily basis about things and share similar interests. We do all of that stuff, but I think that the key really is our employees. We take great pride in recruitment. We go through multiple levels of recruitment. We really want to make sure that everyone is not only excellent at what they're going to be doing at Ellis Porter, but they're a good person, right? And so we've been really fortunate in our teams that we haven't had somebody that's just rubbed anyone the wrong way. We've had a really inclusive environment where individuals have come in and they've got either cultural, religious, or personal beliefs that they would like to highlight and bring to the attention of everyone. We're really accepting of that, and we welcome them to do that. We encourage them to do that. And so it's created this really amazing environment where I think everyone's just, you know, operating really well. And we lent into the remote working lifestyle, and it's worked brilliantly for us.
That's great. I mean, that sounds like all the things we talk with our clients about the culture and how to keep people engaged. So That sounds wonderful. And it's easy to overlook. You get busy, you're growing, going from the numbers you've gone to where you are today. It would be very easy to just say, hey, we're on the growth train, and to kind of forget about those nice things like bringing people together. And so that's wonderful advice. I appreciate that. And that is it for our questions, unless you have anything else you'd like to add to some of the other questions or any other points you'd like to make while we're still recording.
I think just the final point I would say is, as we started off, I think we're going into next year where there is a heightened level of concern and trepidation in some regards regarding immigration. Like I said at the outset, I really would stay off immigration forums, that they can be the worst places to go. I get scared when I go on them, and I sometimes from time to time just check them out to see what the latest rumors are, because I know what clients are going to tell us. They're scary. A lot of the stories on there are incomplete stories. People say, I've never had an immigration issue, and they got denied, and they don't tell you that the person that was in front of the officer, you know, was running an illegal operation somewhere. So stay off the forums, stay off the speculation. Until things get changed, you can adjust, but there's no need to necessarily go over the top now and panic too much, make substantial changes, try and push through applications that aren't ready. Speak with your immigration counselor if you have one. And from companies who have existing foreign nationals in the US, what I would say to them is, speak with your employees, your foreign national employees. Let them know that you're on top of this, that you're speaking with your immigration counsel, that you've got clear lines of communication. It stops them from panicking too much and spinning out of control. And then also speak with the business leaders. Let them know that there may be challenges to immigration. So if they've got projects coming up over the next year or two that they may need some key members from outside of the US to come and work, figure that out. Let's see, who do you think, what type of employee do you think? Have you earmarked an employee? Are they somebody that would meet the criteria for a specialized knowledge worker? Or can you use the next few months to really help bolster their chances of success as an L1? Forward planning for projects, instead of saying, we would normally try to staff the project 2 months before the go live date, maybe you increase that, and maybe it's now 4 to 6 months before the go live date. Those are the things I think are critical at this point in time, without spiraling out of control and making huge programmatic changes. Talking to your foreign national employee population, the business leaders, and your immigration counsel, just to understand exactly what's happening, how to demystify the rumors from reality.
That is great advice. I can feel. I'm not even working on a visa right now, but I can feel the calm that you're just like, okay, it's all right. Just, don't panic. We just have to do this, this, and this correctly based on the environment. So it's great advice, which I knew it would be. So thanks very much, Arvinder, for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this important episode featuring Arvinder Ubi, immigration attorney and partner with Ellis Porter. And thank you, Arvinder, for sharing your expertise guiding foreign corporations and individuals through their U.S. expansion journeys. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, subscribe to U.S. Expansion Minipod on your favorite platform. Published on the first and third Wednesdays of every month, you'll find engaging U.S. expansion discussions with industry leaders and innovators. Don't forget to share this episode with your network and leave us a review. We love hearing your feedback. For more information about Arvinder Ubi and his work at Ellis Porter, you'll find his contact information and a link to their U.S. expansion practice in the comments. This has been Joanne Farquharson, President and CEO of Foothold America, and that wraps up our three questions for today. Until next time, keep expanding your horizons.